Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Later today on the show, we are talking about a new PBS documentary set to be released on Juneteenth. That's the upcoming Monday. Mm-hmm. About a revolutionary Black Philadelphia family.
Very interesting story there. We also want to talk about one of the biggest issues here in Philadelphia, Avi, and that is substance use disorder. You know, on a regular day, you could walk around the city and see people who are under the influence. And I got to keep it real, Avi. You know, we like to do that. Sometimes you'll see people, I'll see people laying on the street. They don't move. And I don't know if they're just napping or if I should intervene and potentially save somebody from ODing on the street. We'll talk with an organization right out of Kensington about how we can become better citizens and potentially save lives.
And that's what it's all about today. It's sort of an unusual segment because we're not going to do abstract conversations about drug policy or whatever. We are really going to focus on what people can do day to day in the harm reduction space. So if you have questions about what you can do or how you can help, or if you've been in a situation in which you had to use Narcan, we want to hear from you. Give us a call right now, 888-477-9499. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org.
And Avi, we talked about this. This is going to be a safe space.
Yeah.
We're open to whatever questions you have.
Absolutely.
But first, we're going to dig into those headlines. And I have the shovel.
Go ahead.
This morning. We'll start with some updates on what we now know about that I-95 accident. We talked about the incident extensively yesterday, but we have a couple of updates. The big one is that officials have now confirmed that the deceased person found below the collapsed overpass was Nathan Moody, a New Jersey truck owner operator who worked for TK Transport, a gas supply company based in Pensauken. The cause of death was he died from blunt trauma to his head and injuries related to the fire. And, you know, there's loss of life there. That's so sad.
He was
a family man.
First.
We acknowledge that first. But I want to mention that this isn't the first time that TK Transport has had a major crash. 8 years ago, another driver was involved in a $1 million damage accident near the Betsy Ross Bridge. That driver ran from the scene, had blamed icy roads for his accidents, yet an investigation found that he was speeding and the driver also had multiple driver's licenses. So there were some issues there. Also, there have been updates on the exact reconstruction plans, and they're expected to be revealed by Governor Shapiro today.
Yeah, and we're getting updates on this today, as you mentioned, including this update, Governor Shapiro saying demolition expected to be done tomorrow. Also, there's going to be a live feed, a webcam showing construction, the rebuilding of this section of I-95 that the public can view 24/7. And we are told work will be happening 24/7 until this is completed. So that is a sort of a transparency measure they're putting in place. And like you said, details still coming out hour to hour to hour. So we're just going to keep our eyes on it and keep passing that information to you guys when we get it.
Yeah. And I want to shout out to all our listeners and the folks who have switched over to mass transit.
Yeah.
I mean, SEPTA has already seen an uptick in ridership. And, you know, traffic on I-95, everything has been backed up on 295 as well. But things are moving. So people are sort of transitioning and coming up with workarounds.
Yeah. And you mentioned mass transit. This has revived, perhaps emphasized conversations around mass transit, how to make it better, including some hearings coming up about the proposed, long proposed, Roosevelt Boulevard subway. We'll get to that another day, but just putting a pin in that for now. Wanted to move over to another story now that was reported by a former colleague of ours here at WHYY, who now works at the Inquirer, Max Marin. A sad story. Philadelphia Zoo says five meerkats died last month. This is all of the meerkats at the zoo, all five of them. It appears to be a case of accidental poisoning. A lot we don't know. Investigation ongoing. That's the disclaimer. It may be linked to a dye that is used on the fur of the meerkats to mark them from one another so they know which meerkat is which. They've been using this dye apparently for decades without issue. But there is some suspicion it may be involved here because this dye was also involved in poisoning incidents for other animals, not the Philadelphia Zoo. So they're looking at that. There's no suspicion of foul play right now, But there is an ongoing investigation. And of course, folks at the zoo and all the animal community all over the region are shaken up by the fact that this sudden passing of five meerkats at the Philadelphia Zoo.
Yeah, and the five siblings, they came to the zoo about 12 years ago. And if you don't know what a meerkat is, I had to look it up myself. They're a small mongoose from southern Africa. Yeah. They're playful animals. They live in large family communities.
They're very
called
social.
Mobs. Yeah, and people kind of fell in love with them with a hit BBC show called Meerkat Manor.
Yeah.
And it followed a family of meerkats in Africa's Kalahari Desert. They were battling rival groups. So can you imagine that? But I want to say this is sad and scary, you know, and I know that people who work at the zoo, they love animals and they would never purposefully do anything on that. But there have been reports that there have been some turnover at
staff turnover at the zoo.
Yes. And that, you know, people have said that maybe the training was kind of rushed, but you know,
and there's staff turnover in a lot of industries
right now.
Right. During the pandemic and after the pandemic, we've just seen lots of people changing jobs and changing where they work. So could that be involved? Again, we don't really know. We don't want to speculate too much at this point. We just know the investigation is ongoing and our thoughts are with the folks at the zoo.
Yeah, definitely thoughts with them. So let's cheer things up a little bit. Let's celebrate it.
Well, it's not my birthday.
It's not my birthday. I'm born in the cold
months.
That's
not why we're playing this.
But today, the Made in America lineup dropped today. Mm-hmm. So, and I came in and, Avi, you were very excited about this lineup.
Yeah, I was pretty excited.
Yeah, so I'll let you, you know.
Oh, you want
I'll give
me
you
into
the
it?
Shovel? Yeah, go ahead. Shovel back to you,
well,
man.
People know about Made in America. It happens every year around Labor Day here in Philadelphia. It's that big concert down Art Museum area, right?
Yes.
It's always been there,
always
right?
been there, yeah.
And people who are younger and cooler than me go to this concert every year. And this year, the headliners are going to be SZA and Lizzo.
Lizzo.
And who we were just hearing, SZA?
Yeah, that no, that was Lizzo.
That was Lizzo.
That
okay.
was one of her, because some of her songs
this is how
have
in the loop I
terms
am.
That we can't necessarily play on public radio,
okay, got it.
Which we sang in the car and in the shower by ourselves all the time.
other artists in the lineup, Miguel, Thames, Metro Boomin, Coco Jones, Lotto, I get that right?
Yes, you got
Ice
it right.
Spice, and Lil Yachty.
And of course, you know, I'm really excited because this is Jay-Z's festival. Mm-hmm. And you know, Jay-Z is married to Beyonce. And this means that we could have two Beyonce sightings in Philly this summer alone. So I just want to put that out there because she's coming on July 12th. For a part of her
renaissance.
I got the date.
Are you going?
I am going.
Oh, congratulations.
And so, you know, so this is like a big deal. So, yeah, and it's a big economic impact.
You know what's also a big deal? WHYY Schooled podcast.
It is.
So we're going to swing it on over to Aubrey Juhasz, hey. WHYY's education reporter. First of all, welcome to Studio 2, Aubrey.
Thanks for having me.
So for people that don't know, the Schooled podcast is in its sixth season here at WHYY. Each season focuses on different stories, focusing really on the people at the heart of our education system here in Pennsylvania. And this season is a real deep dive. It's a three-episode deep dive into this landmark school funding case here in Pennsylvania that could radically reshape the way school districts get money from Harrisburg. So, Aubrey, I'll start there. Tell us why you were interested in taking a deep dive into this particular case.
Yeah. I mean, when we were thinking about what to do this season, it just didn't even feel like we had a choice.
Yeah.
This is the big conversation in education right now. It's the conversation that we circle back to when we talk about anything in education right now. It all comes back to the money. And to some extent, it has always gone back to the money. We just haven't necessarily always wanted to pay attention to it. Yeah. And now the court is forcing the state to pay attention to it. So it felt natural for us to use the Schooled podcast to take a close look at the conditions that led to the lawsuit, to dig into the actual court case, and then the ruling that we had in February. And then in our final episode, which folks will hear in about 2 weeks, we take a look forward and we say, what does this really mean? What's going to happen next?
Yeah, I want to just talk about what struck you. You know, you cover education, and when you really started digging into this and you saw like the reason why this lawsuit existed, because it's been going on for years and years and years.
Yeah.
What struck you when you actually went to visit some of the schools to do this podcast?
Yeah, I think I was struck by how bad it was at some of the schools, and then also how, I don't want to use the word extravagant, but just how much more some other schools have. I think, you know, unless you go to public school as a student and you change districts, you're not going to have that firsthand experience of seeing just how big these disparities are. And I think the reason why we have so much debate in this space is because people's lived experience is so different. Mm. So that's why we really wanted to focus on hearing from the young people that go to this underfunded school district, the William Penn School District, where they have incredibly high property tax rates. But because they don't have a lot of local wealth, they just don't have a lot of funding to pour into their schools. And as a result, their high school, you know, first opened in 1927, has had very minimal upgrades to it since. And that just means that it's not well suited for a contemporary education. The kids aren't in classrooms where they have the equipment that they need, where they even have the space to learn comfortably. And that's just kind of, you know, the most apparent issue. There are so many other things that are happening, not because, you know, teachers don't care and students don't want to learn, but just because they don't have the money to do what wealthier districts can do.
Actually, we have a clip I want to set up right now. This is students from that district talking about what they saw when they went to a school district with far more resources. Let's roll that clip out.
There's like a cafeteria kind of outside. Like, they can kind of eat like outside. There's all these tables. We're like, oh, wow, that's nice.
I thought it was like, this is a fantasy experience because the ceilings were huge.
We go in there. Man, their lockers were the size of refrigerators. You could sleep in there.
The place was spacious. It looked like amazing. It was pristine. It looked like it was updated. I never seen like a fully updated school.
And where this podcast really sings for me, Aubrey, obviously we've only heard the first episode, two more to come, but where it really sings is it's you're able to take this complicated topic and a topic that can, you know, put sort of a snooze on some people's face and give it a human voice. How did you find the people to help tell this story? How did you approach that problem? Because lawsuits, those can be very tough stories to tell.
Yeah, I think, you know, fortunately for us, there's a lot of young people who have been very vocal in this space. You know, there's a lot of young people who have had their consciousness raised on the issue because this court case has been building for such a long time. It was first filed in 2014. So for kids who are curious, maybe they, you know, served on their school board or they had a teacher bring up the issue as a current event, they were looking into this issue themselves. They were figuring out, you know, accessible ways of talking about property taxes and wealth and millages and these things that, you know, even as a reporter can be hard to explain. And fortunately, we were able to lean into these young people and kind of use their language, highlight their work, and let them help us tell the story.
Yeah. When you think about, because this is going to be top of mind as people sort of like figure out what to do with this new money that could be coming, that's very likely to come to some of these districts. What are you hoping this podcast does to sort of prime the pump, I guess, as we have these conversations?
Yeah, I hope that people who maybe, you know, are not up to speed on this issue listen to this podcast and it helps them understand why it's important to respond to the judge's ruling. I think in our third episode, we're going to take folks to Harrisburg, where we talk to a lawmaker who, despite, you know, the excitement of this ruling for advocates, she feels a little stuck. She's a little afraid that we are so divided as people, you know, just in general, and particularly on issue when it comes to spending and equity and school choice and public education, that she's afraid that, you know, people might drag their feet, that this might not be something that comes through quickly. So I guess our hope is that people listen to the podcast and they are confronted with the realities of this. Because like I said at the beginning, you know, if you went to a public school in a wealthy area, your experience will have been far different than a child who's going to school in an area that just doesn't have a lot of property wealth.
Once you hear it, you can't unhear it. And I think that is really one of the powerful things about this podcast. So episode one is out. It's the sixth season of Schooled. Episodes 2 and 3 on the way in successive Tuesdays, right, Aubrey?
Correct, yeah.
That is Aubrey Uhas, WHYY's education reporter and the producer of this season of Schooled. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks
on
for
Studio
having
2.
Me.
Shifting now to the segment coming up, and we already have emails pouring in on this topic. We're going to talk about substance use disorder and harm reduction, what you can do on a day-to-day basis to help people who might be in crisis. If you have an email or something to add, studio2@whyy.org, or you can give us a call, 888-477-9499.
And this, my friends, this is a safe space. All questions welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. You know, as reporters, Avi, and news organizations, we spend a lot of time visiting neighborhoods and discussing the opioid crisis. We've talked about pharmaceutical companies. We've talked a little bit about policies. We've talked about some of the perils of substance use disorder. But today, we wanted to talk about something different.
And this all started with an email from a listener, actually. And I really want to set this up, starting with that email. Listener named Corinne reached out with a very earnest and striking note that I could not get out of my mind. Corinne said she was in Philadelphia recently near Center City, and she saw a young man seemingly, in her judgment, under the influence of drugs and struggling to stand up. And in that moment, I think she had sort of a crisis of confidence, not knowing what to do. Should she help? Should she call 911? Maybe not 911. Maybe call someone else. Corinne, she was overwhelmed, basically.
Yeah, and I've experienced that kind of overwhelm. And unfortunately, we all probably have seen this too often in Philadelphia. And I'm guessing a lot of people feel the same way that Corinne did. They want to help, but have no idea what to do.
And the easy part, or the easy thing, I suppose, to do is to walk away, past it. But then you start asking yourself those questions. Do we have a moral obligation to help? Should we? Maybe we would cause more harm by helping. So today we want to focus this discussion on the how-tos of harm reduction. We're going to leave the big picture stuff for another day. We're going to talk really about the day-to-day actions we all can take.
Yeah. And here to walk us through it is Sarah Laurel, founder and executive director of Savage Sisters, which provides trauma-informed recovery housing, community outreach in Kensington, statewide education, and so much more. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us in Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And we really want to hear from you all today. This is about you. This is a safe space, listeners. What do you want to know? Call us, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. So, Sarah, before we talk solutions, I just kind of want to set the scene and deal with some of the stigma that immediately comes to mind for some people. How should we be looking at substance use disorder, and how should we be talking about it? So give us the language we should use right up front.
I think it's important to use person-first language and to understand that many more people than identify are using substances. Not everybody that uses substances has substance use disorder. And harm reduction seeks to reach people in all different areas. So it could be a person who uses substances, a person who's in long-term recovery, somebody who uses chaotically or situationally, experimentally. And the most important thing is to individualize that interaction by allowing that human to let you know how they identify.
So when you're doing work in the community and you see someone that you think might need help, might need intervention, how do you approach the situation? What do you look for first?
If we're talking about potential overdose, the first thing I'll do is verbal or physical cues. So I'll try to get their attention in a try-to-be-friendly way, have some good bedside manner and say, hey, bro, are you okay? If they respond, I will ask for permission to potentially put them in a safer position. I want to make sure their airways aren't blocked and that they have good circulation. I also want to hold space for them to say, please get away from me. Not everybody wants to be talked to by a stranger. So I allow that person to respond and let me know what they're comfortable with. And then one of the biggest things is asking how I can be helpful to them. I can't assume what they may need or want. Reversing an overdose, or I live and work in Kensington, so it's, you know, pretty heavily impacted by this crisis. I can come across individuals regularly that just need to be put in a safer position. Maybe they need a bottle of water. And I won't find that out unless I engage in dialogue with them.
I have to ask you, what does active use look like? So versus overdose, because you could just see someone and you don't know, like, when should you possibly even intervene?
So if they're responsive to verbal and physical cues, they probably don't need, I mean, you shouldn't administer any kind of naloxone. You can monitor them. You want to look for discoloration of their skin around their fingertips and their lips. Those are usually exposed. So bluish, purple, gray color. Labored breathing. They typically are breathing. However, it's very labored. You can also seizure-like movements. They can be completely unconscious. There's several different ways, but the first thing we always do is try to get their attention by saying, hey, are you okay? And then we do a nail bed press, or we take the flat part of our finger and push in on their throat and go up and down. It causes discomfort but isn't painful, so typically they'll respond. Due to the xylazine and the drug supply currently, it causes heavy sedation. So people can appear to be in distress, but they may just need to be kind of roused in order to make sure that they are okay.
You have a lot of experience in this space. You know all these cues to look for. We're trying to help people today, but people might walk away still not feeling confident enough to make these judgments. Do you suggest that people call someone or some service if they're not feeling confident, or would you prefer just, like, if you really believe the person is in distress, like, jump in right away? Because I feel like that is at the core of a lot of people's conflict and tension, not trusting themselves, essentially.
So if you think that somebody is in distress, you can always call 911. And especially in our community, police don't arrive. It's usually medical professionals that come. It's the firefighters and the EMTs.
And you're so talking about your community, meaning
Kensington.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I know some in Pennsylvania, in the counties and things like that, police do arrive when you call. But, you know, there's no harm, no foul in calling and then having them assess the individual and say that they're okay.
Yeah.
I do suggest that everybody attends an overdose reversal training. You can do it virtually. There's tons of organizations in the community that do them. Our nonprofit offers them, the Department of Health, and several other community-based organizations will literally come to you and train you.
Yeah. And I want to just remind you, if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Sarah Laurel, founder and executive director of Savage Sisters. We are getting solutions today on how to deal with substance use disorder. If we see someone who may be in distress and we want to hear from you, what are your questions? What do you want to know? 888-477-9499. You can email us at studio2@whyy.org. We have someone on the line. Mary wants to know about Narcan or Naloxone. Mary, you're on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
Hi, I have two brief questions. Number one, can you get Narcan for free from a pharmacy? And two, if you administer Narcan to someone, is there a possibility it could have a very negative effect on their heart or lungs or other major body organs, such as if they're elderly?
Those are good questions. So the first one is no, you can't get it for free. As I understand it, you do have to purchase it, but you don't need a prescription for it. However, you can reach out to your local health department. Pennsylvania has single county authorities, and all of them do have naloxone access that is free to Pennsylvanians. If you are administering Narcan to an individual, it's not going to have any body consequences that you mentioned. The only thing that can happen to the person is if they are chemically dependent on an opioid and you Narcan them, they could potentially feel the symptoms of acute withdrawal, which would be uncomfortable, however, not deadly.
And so, assuming that if that happens and the person experiences acute withdrawal, what do you then do as the person who just administered the Narcan? Should you talk to them? Should you should you counsel them through that or just give them space?
So again, I allow my friends to let me know what they're comfortable with, but I am a person in long-term recovery and I have been Narcan'd and I know how uncomfortable it is. I threw up every time. So typically what we do, and again, we're in Kensington dealing with these reversals, is we put that person into the rescue position in case they throw up so that they don't choke on anything. And then we get 6 feet back, down low to the ground, clear the space, let that individual know you're safe. You have to understand that these friends of ours, they're coming back from death. So lower your tone, introduce yourself and say, hey, you just experienced an overdose. You're safe. Can I get you anything? Bottle of water. You want to call your mom. And then if they allow you the space to have a conversation with them, you can say, Narcan works for about 20 to 90 minutes. The opioids are still in your body. You could potentially re-overdose. Do you mind if I monitor you? They might tell you no, and they might walk away, and we have to allow them to do that. It depends on what boundaries you want to set and what you're comfortable doing. I am comfortable watching individuals consume again, which typically is what happens. They want to consume again so that they don't feel unwell, and we will monitor them as they do that to ensure that they don't experience another overdose. If they tell us absolutely not and they want to get away from us, we give them another Narcan, ask them to use in a space where somebody can find them, and keep the Narcan visible on the outside of their book bag if they have a pocket, and not behind a locked door.
Seems like you really center their agency and say, like, hey, this is about what you want. I'm going to ask you, but it's ultimately not trying to override their decisions or their preferences.
Yeah, well, I think that the underlying subtext in our culture when it comes to substance use disorder mm-hmm. is very controlling and dehumanized. I've been to treatment 28 times. I never once had a doctor look me in the eyes and get to know me as a human. I was given a very specific treatment plan, and it was the exact treatment plan every single time. There was no individualized care there. And there was also absolutely no autonomy for me to choose how and if I wanted to heal. And that's what our nonprofit is working on. That's what harm reductionists want to do. We meet you exactly where you are, and we allow you to be a part of this because you're a human and you deserve it.
I want to just ask you a quick follow-up question. What is the rescue position, I think you said?
So it's you want to use the roll somebody onto their left mm-hmm. side if you can. Obviously, people aren't going to always experience an overdose in a good position, but right. if you can roll to the left side, that's important. The arm closest to you, you want to lift above their head so that the meaty part of their arm serves as a like a pillow for them when you roll them. Take the arm furthest from you, put palm to cheek, grab the shoulder and the hip, and roll towards you. When they roll towards you, they're going to be laying on their side. Mm-hmm. And then you pull up their leg, you make sure they have good circulation. This, when they land, they'll have the meaty part of the first arm and the palm catching their hand. So that their airways are open, and if they begin to vomit or anything like that, they're not going to choke on it.
Yeah, and I want to bring in, thank you for explaining that, just in case people didn't know. I want to bring in Kim. She's on the line, has a personal story. Her son was impacted. Kim, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My question is, my son is again in rehab. This is his fifth time. He'll be 19. I'm hoping he completes the 28-day rehab, but as his drug of choice currently is the fentanyl trank found in Kensington, what are the best steps to get him into a sober living program if he completes the 28 days in rehab?
Thank you so much, Kim.
Could you inpatient?
Thank you, Kim. That's a great question.
Oh, I would think that talking to him about what he wants his healing journey to look like, there's a lot of, unfortunately, there's a lot of unsafe locations. So doing a little bit of research within the community and seeing where is good to go and what those facilities offer. Some sober living homes just offer a bed and, you know, you kind of just have to go out into the world. For somebody that's interested in it, find somewhere that potentially he can have something to do as far as programs. You know, for instance, at Savage, we do trauma therapy, kickboxing, yoga, Reiki. There's programs. There's one in New Jersey that does a heavy focus on sports and different things like that for people who have ADHD as well as substance use disorder. There's a lot of really neat programs out there, and engaging him in that and asking him, what do you think would be most helpful to keep you focused and centered and really get you on the right healing journey? The more you involve him in that process and don't try to coerce or control that decision, the more likely he will be to be excited about it and successful.
Kim, do you have any follow-up?
Just that there, he is currently in a local reputable rehab. So I would, if it's like the previous journeys we've had, there will be aftercare is necessary, especially for a long-term fentanyl user, correct?
I don't say that anything is necessary. That would be up to him to decide what's good for him. A lot of people think that IOP is excellent and it helps a lot, many individuals. I personally had to do court mandated IOP and it did nothing for me. So again,
it's just trying to help his choice. My son.
Yeah. I completely understand that, and he's very lucky to have love and support. So you're a great mom.
Well, thank you, and let's hope he completes this journey this time through the 28 days, day by day.
Thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you. And just to clarify some terms, IOP is intensive outpatient. That's what that stands for. Thank you so much for that call, Kim. And we are.
You could just hear, in her voice. Yeah, the love there.
We have a ton of comments coming in. We're going to try to get to as many as we can. We are talking with Sarah Laurel, founder and executive director of Savage Sisters here on Studio 2. Email address is studio2@whyy.org, and the number is 888-477-9499. Ralph has a very specific comment. How do I assist a person in a wheelchair who may be experiencing an overdose?
Tilt their chin back.
Tilt their chin back. Thanks.
Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about xylazine. We've been seeing more and more use of xylazine, a.k.a. Trank. That's what they call it on the streets. Could you tell us, because Narcan, I understand, doesn't necessarily work on this or as effectively. Can you talk about xylazine, some of the challenges people see, and why it's becoming this growing phenomenon?
So we always administer Narcan because xylazine is found in the presence of fentanyl or heroin. So you always want to administer that Narcan, and it can work on the opioid present. We don't currently have a reversal for xylazine. It is an animal-grade tranquilizer that has pretty much become the supply in Philadelphia. It causes heavy sedation, and so the visuals of it, people appear to be in a trance-like state. But the most important thing that we do is we provide rescue breathing and oxygen. Individuals are not as responsive immediately, and so we administer that first dose of Narcan or intramuscular naloxone, and then we immediately move into supporting their respiratory system. And that has been the most helpful for us. Unfortunately, we have to kind of do some more human studies around this, but we have found it to be very effective, and we carry oxygen tanks when we do our street-based outreach.
Email here from Mary asking, so many people don't make it out of substance use disorder. If you feel comfortable, Sarah, Mary wanted to know, what was the turning point for you?
I had no intention on stopping. I didn't wake up and have an aha moment. I had a trauma that took place. I went out a second story window in Kensington and I was in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And I, during that time frame, I somehow managed to put one day next to another. And I remember having, I think, about 90 days sober, and I was learning how to walk again. And I had realized that I hadn't consumed a substance in a very long time. 90 days was a long time for me at that point. Some people have aha moments. Some people get exhausted on the street. Everybody's story is a little bit different. But mine, I was very broken and afraid and didn't really know how to change my life. And I just kind of happened organically.
Yeah, I want to ask you about trauma-informed care. Because people hear this term a lot, and it sounds like you had to deal with whatever trauma that you had. Because people have different reasons for using. Can you talk about that and what good trauma-informed care would look like?
Well, for us, with my nonprofit in particular, the first way that I wanted to support my friends was I wanted to create a safe space for women. A lot of women go through specific types of trauma mm-hmm. when it comes to substance use and homelessness. And so I wanted to create a safe space where women could come and know that they wouldn't be exploited, they wouldn't be brokered, and they wouldn't be taken advantage of, because I had the lived experience of knowing what it felt like and how those kinds of experiences would stop my healing process. So it started out as a female organization. We implement that in all the things that we do because we have, our whole team has lived experience. And so I'm not a trauma therapist. We hire professionals to come in and offer, you know, trauma therapy to our friends and anger management and help them get through the different experiences that they have to when recreating their lives. So it has to be relevant, and you really have to invite individuals in, and you also, like, we have to be very patient with our friends because everybody's experienced different things, and their response may not be typical, but it's understandable.
I wanted to ask, what are the types of scenarios where you absolutely should not intervene and you should not call 911? There were some questions earlier about sort of like less the do's and more the don'ts, I suppose.
Well, I don't, there's no absolutes when it comes to this kind of work, I think. But if the person is awake and responsive and says, don't help me, listen to them. We don't have to call. I mean, I think that would probably be the time that I'm not doing any, if they can verbalize that they don't want help, I'm not going to force my will on them.
Yeah. I want to sort of circle back to that whole trauma-informed care. And we had an email from Matt talking about the link between addiction and mental health. I mean, you bring in counselors. I mean, there's a lot of different, levels of treatments and recovery. And if we're individuals out in the community, we see something, how do we make sure that we're not, you know, impinging on people's space or sort of taking on people's autonomy when they may be battling other things in addition to substance use disorder?
Just be nice. Don't be mean. And understand that we're human beings and nobody is going to, you know, fully disclose all of the negative experiences that they've had in their lives. So it's not isolated to people with mental health and substance use disorder. Just be a good human to other people. And if you don't know what to do, say that. And also, don't try and be a savior for us. We are not asking anybody to save us. I think that's important to remember.
What do you say to people who are thinking, I would like to help, or I'd like to get more involved? I'm scared. You know, I'm scared of doing this work. Do you ever, first of all, do you have people come to you and say that ever? And if so, like, how do you advise them? How do you counsel them?
So I think one of the important things about this work is you have to go into it with no expectations. You know, a lot of people, when they start coming, they're like, oh, we're going to get 10 people into rehab today. Nobody asked you to do that. Maybe give 10 people a bottle of water. Maybe clean up 10 syringes off the playground. There's different ways that you can give back to the community, and there's different ways that you can help. If you're not comfortable coming to our particular neighborhood, that's fine. I get that. It can be scary. But you can do a sneaker drive at your local community center or church. You can donate clothing and not old polyester suits, you know, stuff that our friends actually want to wear. Medical supplies, snacks, and healthy snacks. You know, nutrition's huge. We get a lot of Doritos. We don't get a lot of fresh fruit. So, you know, being intentional and considerate of what you're doing for that community and not, and I don't mean to sound ungrateful, but a lot of individuals will drop off, you know, a case of tuna. We're serving individuals who don't have a can opener. So when I say be mindful and intentional about it, you know, consider the people that you're attempting to serve. If you feel comfortable coming down, serve alongside us. Do what you can. But do something. And don't let it be that you want to come and you want to save people. We're not here to save them. We're here to give them basic human rights and try to clean up the neighborhood that a residential community lives in and has been disproportionately negatively impacted for decades.
It does feel so, like it comes back to be nice, sort of.
It's always be nice.
That's sort of the core of it all.
Well,
thank you so much for putting up with us and our questions and sharing. That's Sarah Laurel, founder and executive director of Savage Sisters. Thanks again, Sarah, for being here.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new documentary shines a light on the life and legacy of James Fortin, a free Black Philadelphian in the 1800s who was a Revolutionary War privateer, wealthy businessman, and abolitionist. Stick with us, lots to come.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Now, we all know the names of the founding fathers: Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, folks who shaped our young country, working just a couple blocks away from where we are right now. But there are many other people who also made important contributions to our nation's history and who have been overlooked for far too long. An exhibit at the Museum of the American Revolution and a new WHYY documentary is celebrating one of those names, James Fortin, a figure we should all know a lot more about.
Yeah, and his story and his family, so incredible. James Fortin was a free black man living in Philadelphia in the 1800s. He fought in the Revolutionary War, became one of the wealthiest African Americans of the time, and was an influential abolitionist. And his children continued his legacy as leading abolitionists and advocating for education for women and for African Americans generally.
So joining us to tell us more about James Fortin, the exhibit Black Founders, the Fortin Family of Philadelphia, and the WHYY documentary, which airs Monday at 7:30, by the way, on WHYY TV 12. Joining us is Michael Idris, African-American Interpretive Fellow at the Museum of the American Revolution. Michael, thanks for joining us.
I am so excited to be here.
Could you just start a little bit background here? James Fortin, born in 1766, I have that right?
1766, correct. So a year just outside of the Stamp Act in 1765. So he is born in what we like to call Revolutionary Philadelphia. So he is born in Dock Ward. That's the old name for Old City. There used to be a creek that would run through called Dock Creek. It's buried now underneath the bowels of Old City. But James Fortin grew up pretty much within the shadow of the museum where we stand on 3rd and Chestnut Street. He grew up on 4th and Walnut. And it's just fascinating to think of the world that he is seeing as a free person of African descent. And I think that's always important to note because he is seeing slaveholders. He is seeing enslaved people possibly being sold at auction. But he is also seeing a bustling city of roughly about 35,000 at this time that is becoming the largest city within North America at this point, not nearly as big as what London will be or what London is represents, but it is definitely something where shipmakers and sailmakers, his father, in fact, is a sailmaker, so he is going to see the trade. He is also going to see possibly other events as they begin to take shape. Folks roll in by 1774, for the First Continental Congress. He is seeing really a vibrant space of as people decide where they're going to align or where they see these events as they begin to cascade.
Yeah, and he's a young person at this time when the country is being created and founded. And there's an argument that he is one of the founders. Could you lay out that argument for us?
Well, to look at this is, I think, a really seminal moment that he witnessed. He is 9 years old on July 8th, 1776, and he is hearing the first public reading of the Declaration of Independence. That puts him at bedrock. That puts him, you know, the founders, those that are drafting the Declaration, it has to hit the people. And he is there at that critical moment that those words on paper are spoken. And who knows to the degree of what that inspires within him. So I think that's a really important piece, because as a person who grew up here in Philadelphia, I never knew that there was a person of African descent to represent that particular moment, to witness that. And I think that's powerful, because that puts people precisely where they need to be to understand how long people of African descent have been engaged in what's going on.
And a free person, a free person of African descent, too. Yeah.
That, of course, is not his only interaction with the formation of the country. He's a sailor in the Revolutionary War. We actually want to set up a clip here from the documentary. This is actor Nathan Alfred Tate portraying James Fortin on an eventful day in Philadelphia after Fortin returned after his first tour fighting as a sailor in the Revolutionary War.
I turned 15 the day I watched the Continental Army march through the streets of Philadelphia on their way to Yorktown. The Rhode Island Regiment, now with two all-African companies, marched proudly by. As brave men as ever fought, they were determined, unstoppable. And I was too. We were doing our part to carve out our place in the new country.
So he is a young man when he decides to take on this perilous assignment. Do we know why he made the decision, or was it a decision to fight? And I know that at some point, I believe he had an option to go to the British side of things and didn't. So explain that.
So I like to think of this as he is seeing, as he sees these events take place, he's thinking, where do I fit in this? And as a free person of African descent, whose father was working in a trade that was important, and he is also going to be educated by a French Quaker named Anthony Benezet. So in his own right, he's thinking service. How do I serve my country? And that is not often the trajectory you think of a person of African descent. But in keeping and understanding that this is a free person of African descent, how he views, I look at it as hopeful optimism to be able to think we can set the table here. And it's also important to understand there are elders, other people of African descent, folks that he'll later get in contact with, Cyrus Bustle, Absalom Jones, the Reverend Richard Allen. They're going to create key institutions that I think Fortin will be, he's like the junior to all of them. And I think that's critical to think about the community that's around him as well and how he is going to engage. And he decides he wants to become a privateer, utilizing his sailmaking knowledge to do something that's practical. And it also, there's some financial incentive for him to do this as well, because he understands that as a privateer, it's a little bit different than a Continental Navy, and that you're going to, depending on your station within the crew, there is opportunities for you to share in the load as you are able to capture British merchant ships. That's really, you're an auxiliary of the Continental Navy, because there's not the numbers of ships to be able to go up against the greatest naval force at that time, which is the British.
And I have to ask you this question, and we don't have a ton of time, but he was a black man, in a free man, in a place where people who looked like him were enslaved. And he became one of the wealthiest people in Philadelphia for his time. Just how was he able to navigate that?
I think James Fortin is a very particular story. And at the museum, we do tell, you know, other particular stories, like Elizabeth Freeman as well, who used documents to like the Declaration as well as the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780 for her freedom. I also think it's really important. And I understand sometimes it's challenging to think about, and the way we kind of look at narratives of allyship. It's different today than it was in his time, but there are different opportunities where people like Robert Bridges, the man that ran the sailmaking loft that James Fortin would have worked at, he saw something unique in his skill set, that he was good at what he was able to do, and he was able to move up through the ranks. I always like to pose this question too, or this thought, is why would Robert Bridges give his business to a person of African descent?
Yes.
And when you unpack that a little bit and you think about, you know, a gentleman who Robert Bridges is a slaveholder to, let's say that, But he is also someone who is looking to build, you know, his children's future. And he's looking at James Fortin and saying, I don't want my kids to do the work I did, but this guy, James Fortin, is someone who is skilled and capable. He will take the reins of my business. Maybe my kids will be a lawyer. Maybe my kid will be a doctor. So it just shows that dichotomy as well.
There's so much more to know about this. And luckily, there is a documentary coming out about this on WHYY TV 12 on Juneteenth, 7:30 and 11 p.m. Michael Idris, African-American Interpretive Fellow at the Museum of the American Revolution. Thanks so much for being with us
today. Thank
you.
Our producers today are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes, who is celebrating 1 year since they became a U.S. citizen. Congratulations. Al Banks is our engineer. And for more on our show, head on over to whyy.org/studio2. I'm Cherry Gregg, and he is Avi Wolfman-Aaron.